speaker for this panel is Susan Higgs, who is a senior lecturer in the Department of Psychology in the University of Birmingham. Susan's work is of real interest to me because she's interested in learning and memory and feeding. And although I believe today she's talking more about pharmacology, I hope she's going to sneak some learning and memory in there somewhere.
I hope to, yeah.
Susan currently serves on the Executive Committee for the Society of the Study of Ingestive Behavior. She has an extensive and impressive publication record. Her work has really focused on biological influences, cognitive influences, on appetite, including the role of learning and memory, in controlling food intake as well as drug intake. And the title of her talk is here, The Psychopharmacology of Feeding, Obesity, and Body Weight Regulation.
Thank you. And thank you very much for the invitation to participate in this wonderful conference. I should explain, the title that was suggested to me actually refers to a special issue of the journal Pharmacology, Biochemistry, and Behavior that I had the pleasure of editing recently with Pete Clifton from Sussex and Michelle Lee from Swansea. So what I would like to do today, actually, is to really share with you some ideas that emerged from the papers in that special issue as they relate to our understanding of the role of the brain in obesity. So, as we've already heard this morning from John Blundell's excellent talk, usually the way in which we conceptualize brain appetite systems is to divide them up into reward systems and homeostatic systems. And then in turn, we think about reward systems as being divided into systems that are thought to mediate pleasure and desire, or liking and wanting, as they have been termed. And then within the homeostatic systems, we have systems that respond to episodic or meal-related satiety signals, along with systems that respond to more tonic signals relating to stored energy, especially in fat. So these systems have been identified to have specific neurochemical substrates. And so if we think about the specific neurochemical mediators of liking, then it's been suggested that the opioid, GABA, and cannabinoid neurotransmission systems underlie liking, whereas the attribution of incentive salience that's thought to be integral to wanting responses is mediated by dopamine. And, of course, a lot of work in this area has been done by Kent Berridge and colleagues, who argue that the ability of food rewards to attract attention and to provide a motivational pull on behaviour rely upon mesolimbic dopamine neurotransmission. Serotonin is identified as a key satiety factor. And, of course, serotonin systems respond to changes that arise from meal ingestion. So what I want to emphasize, first of all, is the importance of behavioral approaches in identifying these specific neurochemical substrates. So if we think about the liking systems in the brain, an important behavioral technique that has been used to elucidate these systems is the taste reactivity test. So taste reactivity responses are orofacial responses that are usually reliably emitted in response to the placement of either sweet or bitter tastes on the tongue. And what we can see in this figure here is various positive hedonic responses. Here we have them in rats, monkeys, and human infants, contrasted with aversive facial reactions there to tasting of bitter substances. And what we know is that opioid agonists, benzodiazepine agonists that stimulate GABAergic transmission, and also also cannabinoid agonists will all increase these positive hedonic responses to tastants. Whereas dopamine, on the other hand, has been shown to have no effect whatsoever on these responses. And alternatively, dopamine appears to be more important for attracting attention to food rewards. So, for instance, mice that are engineered to have excessive levels of dopamine will run more eagerly down a runway in order to obtain food rewards. So in terms of satiety, an important technique has been the behavioural satiety sequence. And this involves observing the very detailed behaviours that, in this case, we can see here that a rat engages in during and after a meal. And what we can see is that as we have a decrease in eating, then we have increases in resting behaviour. And the point at which those behaviours cross over is important in indicating the transition to satiety. And we can look at the effect of drug administration on that particular profile. And drugs that enhance serotonin transmission classically bring forward that transition point, which is consistent with increased satiety. So the behavioural profiling approach can also be applied to the consumption of liquid diets by rats. And so it's possible actually to feed rats nutritive solutions and record each of the licks that they make for these solutions. And this can be done using sort of setup here, where we're automatically able to detect the licks and then divide them up into naturally occurring bouts there of behaviour. And what we know is that in short access tests, where we're giving, say, a very small amount of sucrose to minimise any post-ingestive feedback, we can see that there's an increase in the mean duration of bouts in response to sucrose concentration increase, whereas in longer tests, where we're giving sucrose and allowing there to be post-ingestive feedback, we see a decrease in the number of bouts, suggesting that that measure is perhaps more sensitive to satiety. And so the value of this approach can be illustrated by considering the effects of two anti-obesity drugs, obviously both of which now withdrawn from use due to side effects. But if we look at the effect of these drugs on total lick number, we can see that we get a decrease for both rimonabant here and sibutramine. Both drugs decreasing overall levels of food intake. But analysis of the specific effects of these drugs on the pattern of licking behaviour reveals potentially very different underlying mechanisms. So if we take rimonabant here, we can look at the effect on mean bout duration, and we find that there's a significant effect of rimonabant to reduce mean bout duration, but we have no effect there on the bout number. But we get the exact opposite effect with sibutramine, where there's no significant effect of the drug on the bout duration, but there is a very significant effect there to reduce the bout number. And these data are consistent with ideas that, on the one hand, cannabinoid antagonists like rimonabant are decreasing hedonic reactivity to palatable solutions, whereas with sibutramine, decreases in food intake are being brought about by an enhancement of satiety. So I think that demonstrates the value of taking this kind of behavioural approach. Now, against this kind of backdrop, then, what I'd like to go on and talk about now is what I see as some of the current themes emerging out of the literature on psychopharmacology of appetite. So I think the first thing that's becoming very obvious is that actually the distinction between systems is much less clear-cut. And so one of the things that I'd like to highlight is that actually more detailed investigation of the neurochemical reward circuits reveals considerable overlap between those mediating wanting and liking. And of course, we also know about the complicated interactions between reward and homeostatic systems. Of course, the important work of Peter Schisgel and Stephanie Fulton here identifying links between leptin and dopamine-related reward signalling. But there's now also an emerging literature to show that there are complex interactions between many different homeostatic signals and dopamine reward systems. But that also has to be set in the context of knowledge about the fact that specific diet patterns are having profound effects on to modify, for example, dopamine reward systems. And so we know now that consumption in particular of highly palatable diets, especially according to very specific binge-like patterns, is inducing adaptive changes in those systems. And so there's likely to be a lot of interplay there that is going to be relevant then for trying to understand the development and maintenance of obesity. And of course, one issue is that it's actually quite difficult to disentangle cause and effect there. And finally, I'd like to talk about the expanding areas now that are considered to be involved in the control of food intake. So this fits in with, I think, interest in more cognitive influences on eating behaviour, because it's very clear that appetite-related signals are acted in areas outside of those traditionally regarded to be important for the control of eating behaviour. And so an area, for example, like the hippocampus has now been identified as a target of substances like leptin. So I just want to then highlight some of those themes here for you now. So Susanna Piccina has done a lot of work looking at hedonic hotspots in the brain. So this is identifying areas, specific areas that are responding to the administration of mu opioid agonists, and mapping out those areas using techniques to identify neuronal activity. And doing this, she has identified several brain areas that appear to have to be co-activated in order to mediate liking responses. Most obviously, nucleus accumbens, ventral pallidum, and parabrachial nucleus, but also possibly there may also be involvement of amygdala and OFC, but further work is required there to identify the full extent of this network. But also importantly, and we've seen this figure already today, but this is just to illustrate that actually opioids are also importantly involved in not only liking but wanting. And in fact, there's overlap that we can see here between the hotspots for liking and also then a larger area here in the nucleus accumbens, which is mediating wanting responses, so increasing food intake after opioid administration. So here we can see the complexity there and the fact that for one particular system here that we have an overlap. And that, of course, has implications for the development of therapies. So, of course, we know also that there are these important interactions between reward and homeostatic systems. So by way of illustrating that here, we've got the effects of administration into the VTA of leptin and also ghrelin and having effects on food intake. So this is to highlight the fact that actually it may be fruitful to focus on the interface here between these systems in order to understand better what might be happening in obesity. And I think that's also underlined by the data presented this morning from Paul Fletcher, showing that congenital leptin deficiency is affecting the responses, brain responses in dopamine areas to food rewards. So this is also important because we know that there are important effects of diet on brain neurochemical systems. So we've heard a reference to the work of Bart Hobel already this morning showing that these binge-like patterns of eating can affect the dopamine system, sensitizing it. But I think one of the things here that is unclear, in addition to the fact that the kind of levels of activity that you see are nowhere near those that you observe after drug administration, is whether or not actual more widespread eating patterns amongst obese populations are very similar to these very specific binge-like patterns that we observe under experimental conditions. Also, we have responses to consumption over the long term of high-fat, high-sugar diets to down-regulate dopamine receptors. And there's a suggestion that this may be contributing to compulsive eating patterns in obesity. But I think it is unclear the extent to which currently these responses are more of a compensatory mechanism rather than contributing to the maintenance of these behaviours. But it's certainly clear that dietary patterns are going to have an effect on reward signalling pathways and therefore, in some sense, could be contributing to overeating. So just to finish off with then, I'd like to suggest then that it's important also to consider more cognitive aspects of eating behaviour and how those effects might be mediated in the brain. So we know that opioids are important for wanting and liking, but there's also a more recent suggestion that, in fact, opioids are also involved in more cognitive forms of learning that we've heard about this morning, again, in Paul Fletcher's talk. So there's evidence that administration of a dopamine antagonist actually blocks the normal shift in incentive value that occurs during hunger state, and that's work from Bernard Belain. One area that we're very interested in is the role of the hippocampus, and we know that the hippocampus contains receptors for all sorts of important regulators of eating, and that in fact recent data suggests that leptin infused into the hippocampus can also decrease food intake. And this is consistent with data from ourselves and others showing that, in fact, lesions of the hippocampus can have a very profound effect on eating behaviour. So these are data just from our lab showing this phenomenon of multiple meal eating in amnesic patients. So in this particular study, we gave both controls and patients a meal, and then they could eat as much as they wanted. We then left them alone for 15 minutes, came back and offered the same meal. And what you can see very clearly here is that not only actually do the amnesic patients eat more than the controls at the first meal, they go on to eat a substantial amount at the second meal. And we have additional data suggesting that this is not due to generalized deficits in eating responses, because these are patients that are also showing intact sensory-specific satiety and also normal use of appetite rating scales. So we think that this suggests that actually one factor that may also be important in the control of eating behaviour is being able to remember what you ate for your last meal. And so I'll finish there just then with a quick overview. But really just to emphasise the idea that, in fact, it may be fruitful to look at where interactions between these different systems might be altered in states of obesity. And I think this maybe would be mapping onto the very diverse phenotypes that we've already heard talk about this morning. And so given the time, actually, I'll just finish off by saying also that I think the data and some of the ideas that I've presented reinforce this notion that actually it's also important to consider different stages of obesity because of the likelihood that there are very different mechanisms that are operating during these phases. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Susan.
So I'd like to go to the hippocampal lesion patients. One of the things I remember, I saw a video of HM once, and he was thin. Of course, he lived in an institution and presumably didn't select his meals. But one thing we were discussing yesterday is, do you get obese if you overeat, or do regulatory mechanisms kick in? So are the patients with hippocampal lesions, do they get fat?
The patients that I've studied, similar to HM, they didn't have a problem, you know, with obesity. So I think it's difficult to know why that might be the case because, as you say, in these cases, and we know from looking at diary studies from these patients, their intake is very externally controlled. So, you know, what would happen if they were given, you know, free rein, I don't really know. And I think it's difficult to tell their, you know, whether or not you would see obesity. But I think it's an important point about, you know, whether or not or when we have a failure of regulatory mechanisms, because clearly, you know, all sorts of things are happening in response in particular to consumption of very highly palatable diets. And then, you know, how is it then that we can distinguish between these compensatory responses, the maybe failed regulatory responses, versus those that are actually being effective?
Thank you. Very, very interesting. You know, your point about the hippocampus, of course, reminded me also about some findings that we put in the literature a while ago that were actually mirrored also by Marie Palchat, that found actually an hippocampal response related to craving. The finding that I was referring to was in post-obese subjects that responded to the satiety stimulus that we applied with positron emission tomography as the obese subjects, and both groups were different actually from the lean. So I'm a strong proponent of more attention to the hippocampus as a modulator of eating behavior, because I believe that, and maybe you agree with me on that, I believe that the hippocampus is very important in encoding some aspects of our learning process, and so somewhat modulating how we react to the same stimulus next time, and consequently how we can change our eating behavior depending on the environment that we are exposed to, including learning, of course. And learning happens in many different ways, also by looking at the commercials.
Yes, and I think it may also be that different areas of the hippocampus may be mediating, different processes that are influencing eating behaviour. So I agree the response to environmental cues, for instance, that have been previously paired with food intake in the past, there may be an important role there. We've argued that essentially, there may be some kind of shortcut, really, of a way of encoding information about previous energy intake that allows you then to predict the consequences of future consumption more effectively, which may be compromised, obviously, in the case of the hippocampal lesions.
Your last slide, when you were mentioning the interaction between hedonic, homeostatic, and cognitive, what is the current status of research at that level? That's my first question, in terms of really looking at the interaction between those systems. Mm-hmm. And then second, yesterday we were in the design workshop on transformative innovation, and we had the neuroscience of the senses, and we had the anthropology of the senses. And what the anthropologist was saying to the neuroscience, can't you teach your reward system to be a bit more cultured so that it's less reactive and with detrimental effects? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think that's certainly an area which is attracting a lot of interest right now, is that interplay between, on the one hand, what you might call, the incentive mechanisms relating to reward versus then the dampening down, so, the top-down control. And, in fact, it may be that obesity is arising from a problem with both of those systems. So on the one hand, perhaps some genetically determined predisposition to be more attracted to food rewards combined with, say, then, reduced top-down control. And this may relate to some of the talks that we're going to hear later on impulsivity. So I think certainly there's a lot of interest in the interplay there between those systems, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much for a lovely talk. I wonder if in the editing of your book there was any discussion of a form of iatrogenic obesity that is mediated through various classes of psychoactive drugs, which is well known but doesn't seem to get much exposure at the moment. But I'm thinking of the benzodiazepines, certain neuroleptics, and other classes of drugs,
yes,
which increase food intake, sometimes quite potently.
Indeed.
And if you look carefully, there is a documented literature on weight gain as well, which has been, I should say, carefully suppressed, perhaps by the pharmaceutical industry. But considering the widespread use of such drugs, stretching into millions and millions of people, this together could have an effect on the epidemic of obesity. Is that still a current topic of interest?
Certainly, there was a number of papers actually that addressed the issue of antipsychotic-induced weight gain, I guess because there's a lot of interest in trying to avoid that side effect, which is obviously detrimental in lots of ways. So I think there's a lot of interest in trying to figure out, what aspect of the drug function is contributing to the weight gain so that you can eliminate it. With the benzodiazepines, it's interesting because I think there's less of a consensus on whether or not those drugs are really responsible for, widespread weight gain. And that might partly relate, in any case, to the time of day, when people are normally taking those drugs. So even though there's evidence that they're associated with increased liking and, increased food intake, because they're being used as sleeping medications that... Well, although, of course, with some of those medications, there have been associated with some night eating, but that seems to be restricted to particular cases. I think certainly that there are issues there with a lot of these current drug treatments, yeah.
Great. Before we thank Susan and the rest of our panelists, let me just tell you all that our lunch
break has been shortened by 15 minutes to keep on schedule, so we'll reconvene at 2:15. And now let's thank our panel. It was a fantastic...